Welcome to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We are Flipper, the Family Law Practitioners Association of Queensland. Family law is a wonderfully rewarding career, but is not without its challenges. Join us as we explore the issues that impact on the practice and well-being of family law practitioners. We hope our episodes will not only inform and inspire you, but encourage you to reach your potential. Enjoy this episode.
Welcome and thanks for joining us. My name is Shannon Dakin, and on behalf of the Flipper Board, I'm delighted to introduce Rebecca Fogarty. Rebecca is a QLS accredited criminal law specialist, partner of Jasper Fogarty Lawyers, and the current president of the Queensland Law Society, among other hats that she wears. With an extensive and impressive breadth of experience in criminal law, we're in good hands for today's topic. Rebecca's going to share with us some insights on the new coercive control legislation coming in 2025 and about domestic violence legislation generally. Rebecca, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's an absolute delight to be here. And as you've already mentioned, there's a lot happening and has been happening in the domestic violence and coercive control space. So I'm really pleased actually that you've given me the opportunity to talk about this topic, the new criminal offence of coercive control, because I think it's going to have some implications for family law practitioners when it's formally comes into play next in May 2025.
So what changes are coming in 2025?
What really is happening in 2025 is that there is going to be a standalone criminal offence of coercive control that hasn't previously existed before. And so Queensland, we're not the first jurisdiction to legislate for this new offence in Australia, but we're certainly joining the club. The reason for the offence really stemmed from the very tragic circumstances of the death of Hannah Clark and her three children in Coorparoo some years ago. And I'm sure that that's a story that many of your listeners and members would be well and truly aware of. The offence has come about after some extensive consultation between the Queensland Government and the review that came about by the Hear Her Voice reports led by former President of the Court of Appeal, Margaret McMurdo. So what we have now is a criminal offence that comes with a maximum penalty of 14 years imprisonment. It applies only to adults, so children will not be able to be charged with the offence. And look, it's one that I think, from a black letter point of view, QLS and the Queensland Bar Association and other peak legal bodies have certainly expressed some concerns about whether this law in its current form is going to do what it's meant to do.
And what are the challenges that you foresee in that space?
Well, look, the first thing comes from the definitions of the offence, and I think it's really important that family law practitioners are alive to it. So, as a general rule, criminal laws should be very clear so that everybody is absolutely aware of what behaviour is acceptable and what behaviour is not acceptable. Criminal laws should not be unduly complicated, okay, because what we want is for the community to be able to understand what is illegal and what isn't. And I have to say, as someone who's presented a lot of papers on coercive control, I've delivered at conferences internationally in relation to this specific offence, it's really hard to understand. The legislative provisions are complicated. So if we unpack that a little bit, basically a person who commits a coercive control offence, the elements of the offence are that they're in a domestic relationship with the other person, that they engage in a course of conduct against the other person that consists of domestic violence occurring on one or more occasion. So it really only requires two occasions for there to be domestic violence for potentially the elements of a coercive control offence to be made out. A person has to intend for the course of conduct to coerce or control the other person, and the course of conduct would be, in all the circumstances, reasonably likely to cause harm. So that means that harm is not an element of the offence.
Okay.
There is no requirement for the complainant to have experienced serious harm or any negative impact whatsoever. It's an objective test and it just has to be reasonably likely. The issue really comes from the fact that the definition, as you would know, and as all your members would know, that domestic violence is extraordinarily broadly defined in the Domestic Violence Act. What is interesting is that obviously the Domestic Violence Act is a civil law provision, like the Family Law Act. These are civil law proceedings. And what we have is this very broad definition that was part of a raft of legislation that's designed to be protective that has now been imported into criminal law legislation that has a very different purpose. And so I think it creates a lot of uncertainty. You know, economic abuse, for instance, that can be anything. It can be behaviour that denies economic or financial autonomy for one person, or it can be by withholding or threatening to withhold financial support. And, you know, disputes over support in a family law context, disputes over financial separation in a family law context, are things that arise all the time as part of the ordinary, legitimate fallout of trying to help people pick up the pieces of their lives after a relationship breakdown. So I think there is concern that these provisions are so broad that it could impact family lawyers being able to do their jobs, criminal lawyers being able to do their jobs, particularly those working in the domestic violence space. But more importantly, it could mean that people are going to be charged with offences, with a criminal offence for behaviour that has never previously been sufficient to meet the threshold for criminal sanction. And when one has regard to the enormous consequences that can flow from a criminal charge, let alone a criminal conviction, that's something we all have to be prepared to interrogate.
And in terms of family lawyers going about their work, particularly with property settlement, spousal maintenance applications and those sorts of things, can you foresee potentially any issues that a family lawyer might run into in, for example, writing to a lawyer on the other side of the matter about what they can and can't pay and those sorts of things?
That's right. And I think part of the difficulty arises from the fact that what happens in relationships is deeply subjective. And what's normal in one relationship or appropriate in one relationship may not be normal or appropriate in another relationship. And so what is a reasonable expense for one relationship is totally context dependent. And I think that that issue of financial separation is a really interesting one. I've had a situation recently for a domestic violence matter where my client and his family lawyers have proposed that financial separation occur, meaning the parties have their own separate bank balances and no longer have the pay from one party going into the joint account for both parties to spend as they will. I became concerned, though, for reasons that I won't go into, that mere act of writing about the need for financial separation and then my client proceeding to implement that course of action to achieve financial separation might put him at risk of being on the receiving end of a charge of breach in a domestic violence order.
Oh, that's very interesting.
And I'm not saying, like I said, I've encountered it recently, but I can't say it's a common thing, but it's certainly something to be aware of, particularly if there's disagreement about what are the ordinary reasonable living expenses. That can become compounded, I think, in the context of a relationship breakdown where there's often less money available to both parties, particularly where they're litigating and particularly where lawyers are involved. And perhaps one of the reasons that one party or both parties aren't able to continue to exist in the standard that they lived before separation is because the costs of separation means that the pool of money that's available is depleted.
It's going down. And what about other scenarios where, for example, if a party moves out of the former matrimonial home and, as you say, the finances get whittled down, you have now two households. What about a scenario where that person is no longer able to meet the payments for, say, utilities that are at the former matrimonial home where the other party might be living and has to take steps to cut off those utilities or, you know, give notice? Is that potential issues?
Absolutely. They're all potential issues. And I think what it really does is underscore why making that the domain of the criminal law And bearing in mind these are marginal cases, so there's going to be really serious and obvious cases of coercive control where any person looking at it will say, well, that's unacceptable, that's illegal, that's behaviour that has to be sanctioned by the criminal law. The difficulty with really broad definitions, though, is they don't just capture the most serious cases. They capture the marginal cases where there are real and proper questions to be asked about whether we as a society want to have this level of, I guess, in a way, government intervention in our relationships. And I think, you know, these ideas of reasonable living expenses, they're inherently subjective. Yes. And so it means that determining, well, what is a reasonable living expense, or what is behaviour that's intimidating, or what is behaviour that's unreasonable, it makes it a highly contextual exercise. And I think it's important to remember that relationships are incredibly diverse. Mm-hmm. Relationships carry with them all sorts of differences that are born of parties' generations, their cultures, their background, their religion, whether it's a same-sex relationship, whether, you know, whether there's just so many variables and factors that I think makes determining coercive behaviour or controlling behaviour, particularly when there is no requirement for actual harm to be suffered, an extraordinarily difficult, and in some cases, in those marginal cases, an extraordinarily fraught task.
What about for family lawyers at the coalface, say at their initial consultation, once these laws come in, what are the sorts of things that they should be looking out for or be alive to?
Yeah, great question. It reflects, I think, this interesting situation where, as lawyers generally, we're all becoming more and more specialised. You know, I'm a criminal defence lawyer. I don't do anything else. You're a family lawyer. But it means that despite these hyper areas of specialisation, we have to be alive to issues in other areas of law that are going to overlap and impact upon our clients. Now, from a family law perspective, I think that means being alive to the fact that there is a huge spectrum of behaviour that now qualifies as either domestic violence for the purposes of the Domestic and Family Violence Protection Act, or that potentially falls within the ambit of coercive control for the purposes of the Criminal Code Act. And it's incumbent, I think, on family lawyers, particularly when they're in the phase of instructions where they're formulating, getting the information they need for an affidavit, to be able to advise clients of that. And the advice is obviously going to depend on whether a person appears to be a victim of a criminal offence or a victim of domestic violence, or whether a person appears to be at risk of having allegations of that behaviour being made against them. And that would require a referral to the police or to a criminal defence lawyer, as the case may be. But it's also going to impact the actual physical work. Mm. I've noticed it myself in domestic violence, now that coercive control has become a bigger issue that people are more and more aware of, that establishing it to a proper evidentiary threshold is something that requires, that's more laboursome, okay? It means that more time has to be spent getting instructions and setting out in the affidavits or relevant statements the context, the factual circumstances. You know, these might be events that are separated by several years, yet it's still exceptionally important to be able to show why in the mind of the victim of the violence this contributes to a subjective, a strong belief that it's behaviour that's designed to coerce them or control them, and why they don't feel able to change that status quo. And I think because there's this inherent subjectiveness to these concepts, it means that the courts will interrogate it. It means that the courts will look closely at what is the evidence, what is reasonable here, what are the facts that found a person's belief before making any sort of order. And as lawyers, our obligation then means being very prepared and being aware of the need to include a lot more detail than we might otherwise want to.
In terms of moving back to domestic violence legislation, so I understand there were some changes that came in 2023.
Yeah.
Do you just want to touch on those briefly?
Yeah, look, there's been some interesting changes. And look, anyone who's working in this space knows that domestic violence has been a huge focus of the current government, noting that we're talking in September 2024, so there may be a different government in place when this podcast is released. But it has been a massive area of legislative focus. That's not just in Queensland, I should say. It's actually all over Australia and all over, you know, Pacific nations who are our near neighbours. It's very much the issue of the moment, and a lot of those changes have been, I think, far-reaching and profoundly important. So the recent ones, the most recent tranche of changes to the Domestic Violence Act have focused on an interesting issue, I think, which is the idea that courts should now not make cross orders except in exceptional circumstances. Now, I'm sure all your members know this, but just for completeness, cross applications and cross orders are where both parties allege that they have been a victim of domestic violence and that the other person has been a perpetrator of domestic violence, and a court makes orders against both of them. It's always been a bit of a vexed area because of the prospect of systems abuse, because of the prospect of victim misidentification, and because of the prospect that the wrong person might end up as the respondent to a domestic violence order. And, you know, there's certainly a really sound theoretical and academic basis for that, and certainly one in practice. I've been involved in numerous matters where it has been incomprehensible for me why my client is the respondent to a domestic violence order when it's very, very clear in every way that they are the true victim. But the problem is that human relationships are messy. Human relationships don't follow what the academic research might necessarily show. Human relationships involve situations where both parties, particularly where a relationship is breaking down, where both parties are not their best selves, where both parties can engage in forms of domestic and emotional abuse towards each other. It's also explicitly, I think, heteronormative legislation. So legislation with a deliberate gender focus. And again, good, sound academic reasons for that, but perhaps doesn't necessarily then reflect the lived experiences of people who are in non-binary relationships or relationships that don't follow a fixed heteronormative pattern. So that's interesting. And what it certainly has resulted in is a big reduction in the use of cross applications. No doubt that reduction is partly a good thing because it means that people who were inclined to use cross orders as a means of retribution or as a means of revenge, I think that the law has importantly deterred those sorts of unmeritorious applications. But perhaps it has also deterred the making of an application for a cross order in those proper exceptional circumstances.
Okay, that's interesting. And in terms of family lawyers that perhaps are working mostly in the family law space but are thinking about moving into work in domestic violence proceedings in the court, do you have any pointers or tips for them?
Oh, look, I think that's a really interesting question because both criminal defence lawyers and family lawyers obviously occupy domestic violence work. And that's a great thing, I think, because family lawyers have a different skill set to criminal lawyers. And, you know, in every domestic violence matter that I've been involved in where I've worked alongside a family lawyer, I have always learnt something incredibly valuable from the family lawyer's insights and the different perspective that their background brings. So I'm actually all for criminal lawyers and family lawyers working alongside and working together. We are different species, though, and I think it's important to acknowledge that. And certainly this is just my anecdotal, my own personal experience, but I think because the state magistrates' courts, where criminal lawyers spend all their time or spend, you know, most days of the week, probably there's a greater degree of familiarity with the processes of those courts and with the magistrates who preside over proceedings. Just as when I go into a family court, I really do feel like a fish out of water. It's just not my environment. I think one thing And this applies to every lawyer that, you know, the art of good persuasion comes from knowing who it is that you have to persuade. And I think it's important for family lawyers to recognise that many magistrates, all of whom are extraordinarily well-trained, all of whom receive intense and specialist training in the area of domestic violence, will be more likely to come from a background from state laws and criminal law rather than family law. There's exceptions, of course, as there always is. But I think that's an important thing to bear in mind. And in addition, although the domestic violence court is developing its own protocols, it is developing its own jurisprudence, a lot of that is still happening as we speak. And so I still think when appearing in that court that many of the conventions of practice and many of the way in which proceedings occur still tends to follow much more state protocols and state processes than federal family court processes. And so that's an important thing to be aware of. And look, as always, I think, though, that we can all learn from each other. And my practice is enriched by exposure to the excellent family lawyers that I work with. And I hope that that sentiment would be reciprocated, because we have a lot to learn from each other.
Absolutely. Rebecca, thank you. It's been wonderful to have you on the podcast, and we look forward to having you on again in the future.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We hope you enjoyed the podcast today. We confirm that the information we discussed today was just that, information for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not specific advice. If something discussed has you considering whether you should take steps, it is important to make sure you get professional advice about your unique situation before you proceed, whether that be legal, financial, accounting, medical, or other advice. Please reach out to Flipper if there's another topic you'd like explored, and if you know someone who might benefit from the show, remember to tell them about it. Thank you for listening.